Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Examiners, case was some of the worst abuse ever seen by Kim Smith, a little Odessa girl who told investigators in 2019 that she'd been repeatedly raped by a family friend reported being sexually assaulted by the same man 2 years earlier. But authorities didn't have enough evidence to make an arrest. Tuesday was the second day in the trial of Gary Landreth, an Odessa man who is facing four counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child, one count each of sex abuse of child, continuous human trafficking, and injury to a child. Landreth was arrested in January 2019 after a five-year-old told a forensic interviewer she was sexually abused by Landreth, a family friend, and a physical examination confirmed she'd been abused. On Tuesday, Lieutenant Thomas Paz of the Ector County Sheriff's Office told jurors that in 2017, the same little girl was brought to the sheriff's office after telling someone Landreth had touched her inappropriately. The child was later interviewed by a forensic interviewer at that time as well, but the investigation stalled, Paz said. The then three-year-old girl did not say anything that justified a physical exam, and interviewers weren't convinced she knew the difference between the truth and a lie, Paz said. In addition, they believe she may have been coached as to what to say during the interview. Jurors were shown a video of that forensic interview. Early on in the interview, and without prompting, the girl said, "Gary put his finger down there and he touched me." The interviewer swiftly moved away from the topic in order to confirm the girl knew the difference between the truth and a lie. The girl was able to properly identify balls, dogs, cats, and other items in pictures that were shown to her. But when the interviewer would point to the picture and purposely misidentified the item, the girl was just as likely to say right as wrong. Paz told Assistant District Attorney Courtney Williams that when he spoke to Cheryl Harmon, the child's mother, she told him Landreth hadn't been around any of her children for months and she would no longer give him access to the children. In hindsight, Paz said he should have investigated further and interviewed Harmon more in depth. Harmon was also arrested and indicted in 2019 after she told authorities she'd accepted $400 from Landreth for access to her children. She was charged with abandonment, endangerment, continuous sexual assault of a child, and human trafficking. The 40-year-old pleaded guilty to the abandonment endangerment charge and agreed to testify against Landreth in exchange for having the other two charges dismissed. On Tuesday, Harmon told jurors she was a single mother of a five-month-old boy when she moved to Odessa in December 2009 to get to know her biological mother, who had lost custody of her and her siblings in the late 1980s. She met Landreth at church through her mother, and he offered to watch her son while she worked. Eventually, she moved in with Landreth, and when she became pregnant by another man with her daughter in August 2013, Landreth agreed to continue to watch both children, Harmon said. Harmon testified she never paid Landreth for rent and what money she earned while working 40 plus hours a week at Taco Bell went for food and her children's other needs. After a while, Harmon says she moved in with a boyfriend and the children began splitting time between her mother and Landreth when she was at work. She eventually had another son in September 2015, but Landreth didn't watch him as much as the other two children, Harmon said. Harmon told jurors she didn't know many of the details of the 2017 investigation, other than the fact she learned Landreth had been bathing the girl. She said she remembered telling Landreth her daughter was big enough to bathe herself and he should allow her to do so. She admitted she allowed Landreth to continue watching the children after the investigation, although her daughter would sometimes cry when she dropped them off. And she'd told her on at least two occasions that he'd hurt her. I didn't have anyone else to watch her, and I had to work, Harmon said. Harmon gave contradictory testimony to Williams and defense attorney Michael McLeish about the $400 she said she received from Landreth. She said the money was just for the kids to go over there. But she also said the money was so Landreth could have sex with her daughter. Harmon's former boyfriend, John Phillips, who didn't father any of Harmon's children, told jurors he rarely watched them because the older two had a love-hate relationship with him. He also said that at the time he was 600 pounds and struggling with mental health issues. He didn't interact much with Landreth, but he does remember Landreth once telling him he didn't need a girlfriend because he had Harmon's daughter. Under cross-examination from McLeish, Phillips denied applying a negative connotation to the quote only because Landreth was arrested. He said the oddness of the statement had always been in the back of his head. The jurors also heard from two sexual assault nurse examiners and a licensed clinical social worker Tuesday. The Sains, Tella Whitley, and Lisa Montoya testified the injuries sustained by the child were among the worst they've ever seen, could not have been the result of childhood accidents, and clearly were the result of repeated acts. Whitley testified the child told her she had told her mother Landreth had been giving her white medicine with his hand and his penis, and her mother had replied, "He's stupid." Kara Davis, the licensed clinical social worker, testified she worked with the child for 13 months following the arrest of her mother and Landreth. Although she engaged in highly disturbing behavior during that time frame, she is now doing really well in the home of her adoptive parents, although she will likely suffer lifetime consequences as a result of the abuse, David said. Forcing her to testify in a room full of strangers would cause severe regression, Davis said. The state rested their case without calling the girl to the stand. The trial is expected to wrap up Wednesday. Quick hits. Superior marking anniversary. The West Texas Food Bank, 411 South Pagewood Avenue, is hosting Superior Optimization to celebrate their 20th anniversary at 1:30 p.m. today. Superior co-founder Don Bennett donated the anchor gift for the 2012 Capital Campaign, and without this gift, the food bank would not be as successful as it is today. The team from Superior will work the distribution line at 1 p.m. today. Online survey, library town halls. The Ector County Library Advisory Board, along with the Ivy Group, is seeking community input about the future of the library and how it can address the needs of the community. The Ivy Group will also be conducting a telephone survey through the month of April and holding two town halls at 6:30 p.m., April 4th through the 5th at the Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street. For more information, call 432-337-1492. Raising Cane's to Open by OA News. Located at 4001 East 42nd Street, Odessa's new Raising Cane's will officially open its doors March 29th. To celebrate, Odessa's mayor, fire chief, police chief, and Chamber of Commerce will host an official ribbon-cutting ceremony starting at 9:30 a.m. Cane's will accept entries from 8:30 to 9 a.m. for its Lucky 20 drawing to award 20 customers ages 13 and older for free Cane's for a year, a news release said. Winners will be drawn between 9 and 10 a.m. and you must be present to win. The first 100 dine-in customers will also receive a free Cane's t-shirt. The UTP band will join Odessa High School and Permian High School's cheer and band members in pumping up the opening week crowd. Leo Cairo from B93 will also host an on-site radio remote from 11 to 1 p.m. Then on Wednesday, March 30th, the new restaurant is partnering with the Odessa Humane Society to host on-site pet adoptions, and on March 31st, customers will receive a free swag bag with every mobile order placed throughout the day. To round out the four-day celebration, a local mariachi band will entertain the crowd, while the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce hosts a ribbon-cutting ceremony starting at 9:30 a.m. on April 1st. Raising Cane's will also donate $10,000 to various organizations throughout the Odessa community during opening week. Cane's has hired more than 200 crew members and is still hiring more for its new Odessa restaurant. Interested candidates should apply at workatcanes.com. Applicants will be contacted to set up an interview after applying. Odessa's new Raising Cane's will serve customers through its mobile app, takeout, dine-in, double drive-through, and on its large patio. Open every day from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m., Raising Cane's will be the perfect destination for lunch, dinner, and late-night meals. When Odessa's first Raising Cane's opens, it will mark the 183rd in Texas and 618th system-wide, the release said. Woman charged in fatal hit and run. Tragedy shut down part of 42nd for hours Tuesday. By OA News. A 25-year-old woman was arrested after she was involved in a hit and run that resulted in the death of a 28-year-old man. Christy Contreras was charged with accident involving death, a second-degree felony. The reported fatal accident happened at 7:07 a.m. Tuesday near the intersection of East 42nd Street and Grandview Avenue, an Odessa Police Department press release detailed. Police say medical personnel arrived on scene and advised that the pedestrian, a 28-year-old man, was dead. The 28-year-old man was identified as Michael Joe King. The press release detailed a witness told police the victim was standing in the left turn lane on the 1900 block of 42nd Street when a red vehicle was traveling eastbound. The red vehicle struck the victim in the left lane turn and fled the scene by turning northbound on Grandview Avenue. The investigation showed the vehicle was a Toyota Corolla and the driver was identified as Contreras. An arrest warrant was obtained and she was arrested without incident. She will be transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. The investigation continues. Obituaries. Nelda Jane Tandy, Glen Rose, Texas. Nelda Jane Tandy was called home by her Savior, Jesus, on March 17, 2022. Nelda was born August 26, 1943, in Gideon, Missouri, to Oval A. Martin and Elsie J. Richley Martin. She is survived by her husband, Michael J. Tandy, son, John A. Tandy, daughter, Jennifer L. Jimenez, one grandchild, and one great-grandchild. Nelda was preceded in death by her parents, Oval and Elsie Martin, sister, Shirley Wyatt, youngest son, Jason M. Tandy. Any memorial would be appreciated, but please consider the First Baptist Church Forward Building Campaign or a charity of your choice in lieu of flowers. A celebration of life service will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, March 25th at First Baptist Church, Glen Rose. A Lie in State will be held from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. on Wednesday, March 23rd, and Thursday, March 24th at Wiley Funeral Home in Glen Rose. A private graveside will be held. Edith Lipson Hammond Hardy, Odessa, Texas. Edith Anita Hammond Lipson Hardy died peacefully at home in Odessa, Texas on March 16th after a lengthy illness. She was born April 3, 1928 to Timmons Marvin Hammond and Maddie Ethel Womack Hammond in Elmore, Alabama. She was married to Noam Lipson on May 30, 1953, until his death on August 28, 1983. She married Eugene F. Hardy on June 19, 2004. Family visitation will take place at 1 p.m., followed by a celebration of life at 1:30 p.m. in Eagle Pass, Texas, March 19th at Yeager Burrow Mortuary, 1613 Del Rio Boulevard, Eagle Pass, Texas, with a burial to follow at Eagle Pass Catholic Cemetery. A memorial service will be held in Odessa, Texas, on March 16th at 3 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church. Edith was preceded in death by her parents, her first husband, her daughter-in-law Janet Lipson, her sister Dorothy Jones, and husband Marvin, and her brother Lester Hammond. Left to treasure her memory are her husband Eugene Hardy, her sons Tim Lipson and wife Lise of Michigan, Ted Lipson of San Antonio, Dr. David Lipson and wife Beth of Odessa, and her sister Reba Hammond of Alabama. She is survived by four granddaughters and two great-granddaughters. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to Westminster Presbyterian Church. Danny Marlene Wall, Odessa. Danny Marlene Wall, 69, of Odessa, passed away on Sunday, March 20th. A memorial celebration of life will be held on April 2nd at 2 p.m. at 2810 Anna Drive in Midland, Texas. Marlene was born on September 24, 1952, to Daniel and Willie Mae Palmer in Brady, Texas. Marlene married Ray Wall on April 15, 1982. Marlene is survived by her daughters, Kelva and Carl Reynolds of Midland, Gabrielle and Ryan McKendrick of Lampasas and Dana and Shay Tennyson of Odessa, and 9 grandchildren, her brother Greg and Peggy Palmer of Harlingen, and many nieces and nephews. Marlene is preceded in death by her parents, her sister Jennifer Hensley, and her husband Ray Wall. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Hospice of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Natalie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Death notices. Francisco A. Pancho Bailon, Kermit, Texas. Francisco A. Pancho Bailon, 90, of Jal, New Mexico, died Sunday, March 20th in Kermit. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. March 24th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church in Zaragoza. Burial will follow at Zaragoza Cemetery. Family Services Funeral Parlor is in charge of arrangements. Leslie Jean Patrick Couch, Odessa. Leslie Jean Patrick Couch, 71, died Sunday, March 20th in Odessa. American Heritage of Midland is in charge of arrangements. Carolyn Ann Haltom, Odessa. Carolyn Ann Haltom, 84, of Odessa, died Friday, March 11th in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, March 24th at First Baptist Church. Graveside services will be Saturday, March 26th at 10 a.m. at Byron City Cemetery. The family will receive friends from visitation on Wednesday, March 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa. George Hawkins Jr., Odessa. George Hawkins Jr., 87, of Odessa, died Sunday, March 20th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 11 a.m. March 24th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Joseph Malcolm Joe Mount, Odessa. Joseph Malcolm Joe Mount, 91, of Odessa, died Tuesday, March 15th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Saturday, March 26th at Crescent Park Baptist Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Odessa Funeral Home.
This is Jane reading for the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, March 23rd. Substance use disorder is chronic disease. It has own process, can affect people's brains differently. Substance use disorder is a condition often surrounded by misunderstandings and stigma. It is a chronic disease of the brain that requires ongoing support and change in the public's perception. Some individuals may need different levels of treatment depending on the severity of their disease and what substance is being chronically used. This disease has its own process and can affect different aspects of an individual's life that may include medical issues, family distress, loss of relationships, loss of job, loss of financial support, and legal issues. Symptoms of substance use disorder can greatly depend on the person. Here are some signs and symptoms that may require further screening or evaluation. Requiring more of a substance to achieve the desired effect. Emergence of withdrawal symptoms like shaking, increase in blood pressure, seizure, profuse sweating, and craving. Need to use upon wakening. Withdrawn from family and friends. Changes in behavior or personality. Engaging in risky behavior. There is hope for recovery. Treatment programs are available, both inpatient and outpatient, depending on the needs of the individual. Sober housing is available in the community. There are also organizations in the community that offer support and guidance to the person and family, such as Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and Al-Anon. As a society, there are changes we can make to combat the stigma surrounding those that have a substance use disorder. Stigma can be crippling and affect a person's recovery. There are different forms of stigma, including self-stigma and social stigma. Self-stigma can be detrimental in keeping the person from seeking help due to feelings of guilt and shame. Social stigma involves groups promoting stereotypes of stigmatized people that may inhibit engagement in treatment. Here are things we can do to promote the health and wellness of our community. Understand there is not a one-size-fits-all treatment for substance use disorder. Choose words that support treatment and recovery. Self-care and healthy boundaries are essential for loved ones. And education on substance use disorder is essential. If one believes alcohol or other drug use is affecting life negatively, hope is possible. This is Jane reading for the Midland Reporter Telegram on Wednesday, March 23rd. Sleeping with light on may be harmful. From the streetlights outside our bedrooms to the lamps and devices inside, sleeping with some amount of light has become a way of life for many. That may not be such a bright idea. Research suggests that sleeping in a moderately lit room could affect metabolic and cardiovascular health compared with snoozing in a room with dimmer light. In a study published in PNAS, researchers at Northwestern University had two groups of 10 young adults sleep in differently lit rooms. One group slept in rooms with dim light for two nights. The other slept one night in a room with dim light and the next in a room with moderate overhead light, about the equivalent of an overcast day. Participants wore heart monitors at night. In the morning, they did a variety of glucose tests. Both groups got the same amount of sleep, but their bodies experienced very different nights. Both groups responded well to insulin the first night when they both slept in dim lighting. On the second night, however, the group sleeping in brighter lighting didn't respond as well to insulin. The dim light sleepers' insulin resistance scores fell about 4% on the second night, while the bright sleepers rose about 15%. Their heart rates were faster on the bright night, too. Just a single night of exposure to moderate room lighting during sleep can impair glucose and cardiovascular regulation, which are risk factors for heart disease, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, said Phyllis Zee, chief of sleep medicine at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and a Northwestern medicine physician who led the study.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Ivermectin and COVID-19. Dear Dr. Roach, could taking ivermectin as an alternative to vaccination for COVID cause damage to the retina? Answer. When used at appropriate doses, ivermectin is a safe and effective medicine for certain parasite infections. Ivermectin has not been shown to be effective for COVID-19 and should not be thought of as an alternative to vaccination, since it does not prevent infection. It also should not be thought of as an alternative to effective treatments, such as some monoclonal antibodies or Paxlovid. There continue to be clinical trials testing ivermectin, but the studies published, excluding those that have been retracted, to date have not shown significant benefit to ivermectin. There were studies that showed that at high doses, ivermectin shows viral replication, but those levels cannot be achieved in the blood. Some people have used veterinarian products that were never intended to be used on humans. although I found reports of retinal damage using ivermectin in several animal species, I did not find reports in humans. Reported side effects included nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, diarrhea, headache, blurred vision, dizziness, fast heart rate, low blood pressure, visual hallucinations, confusion, loss of coordination and balance, and seizures. You can hear the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday with replays at 12 midnight and 8 a.m. the next day.
This is the Dear Abby column. Aunt fears her nieces are in danger at home. Dear Abby, I'm concerned for my sister and her three young daughters. She has been married to Rick for 10 years. After she recently discovered he has inappropriate feelings toward children, she kicked him out of their home. Rick has gotten counseling and therapy and tells her it's no longer an issue. CPS got involved, so he isn't allowed to be alone with his daughters. My sister allowed him back into their home with the understanding he wouldn't be alone with the girls. She now realizes he still has a problem, and she's considering divorce to keep them safe. I'm concerned because she is conflicted. She thinks he'll get better after more intense therapy, but I'm afraid this is his way of not losing access to his girls. I think she should cut all ties to keep her daughters safe. What can I do to help my sister make the better choice for her and her daughters, who are under the age of 10? Signed, Worried Sister in California. Dear Worried Sister, as long as your sister's children are minors, their mother must protect them, and that includes ensuring they are not alone with their father. Their safety must be paramount. She doesn't appear to realize how difficult pedophilia is to treat. That's why it's important for her to talk with a mental health professional and CPS. Her first allegiance must be to her vulnerable girls, who may need therapy themselves at this point. Dear Abby, I have a friend Amy who I've known since third grade. We both came from difficult family situations, and because of those tough early years, we formed a close bond. We are more like sisters than friends. Over the past few years, Amy, who has always struggled with weight, has put on more than 100 pounds. We live far apart, and although she mentioned, quote, a weight gain, unquote, it wasn't until we video chatted and she was modeling a new outfit that I realized she has become morbidly obese. When my mother went through menopause, like Amy, she gained significant weight. Like Amy, Mom avoided exercise and healthy food. My mother died of a massive heart attack at 57. I'm scared I'm going to lose my friend. She's pre-diabetic with a host of weight-related health problems, but weight is something that culturally we aren't allowed to talk about. And it's something she's sensitive about because her parents constantly harped on her about her weight, even when she was only a few pounds overweight in her teens. Do I say something and hurt/offend my friend? Is it none of my business? I love her and I don't want to lose her. What do I do? Signed, Torn Up. Dear Torn Up, I assume that because you and Amy have been friends since childhood, she knows what caused your mother's early death. If you talk to her once about your concern and explain that you are worried about losing her, I can't see how it would offend her. Because she is pre-diabetic, I would hope that she is being monitored by her doctor. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.